You are listening to NativeQuestions.com, a podcast series by UC San Diego's Practicum in Tribal Law and Journalism.
When we're talking about decolonized too, you gotta take apart the whole thing. Your mind gotta be decolonized now. Because, you know, all of us, just like, you know, I was talking to Malco the other day. When we eat Hawaiian food or we hear Hawaiian music, that is actually not the music that our people grew up with 200 years ago. Every part of our lives has some sort of colonization on it. So we gotta be real about that too. And we gotta understand, and we gotta, you know, to decolonize is to go back to original. And is that really happening today? Is that happening with all peoples? You know, we gotta know that we all live right now. So if we can decolonize right now, you know, our mind and just think into perspective, who are you as an individual? What are you? You know, I now identify myself as 100% Hawaiian. Decolonization starts with your mind. You know, what is your mindset? You thinking like a Hawaiian, you are a Hawaiian. Okay. Now, once I cleared that up with myself and I took care of my own personal issue, now I can go help my people get back our country. You know, get back what we're fighting for, which is national identity. You know, Hawaiians, we had a Hawaiian country. That's what I want, because I like match my mindset to my political view now. You know, I'm Hawaiian.
So you're here today with Angela, Jessica,
and Hashim.
And we are Hawaiian Sovereign 3. You just listened to Brandon, a member of the younger generation of Native Hawaiians involved in the sovereignty movement. We had a chance to talk to him and his uncle, Dennis Bumpy Kanahele, a renowned activist and leader of the movement, in addition to Dr. Miley Arvin, a postdoctoral fellow, assistant professor of ethnic studies at the University of California, Riverside. And together, they helped us understand our question today. What is the Hawaiian sovereignty movement?
One of the first things we spoke to Bumpy about was why we're making this podcast, and he brought up the role academia plays in activism.
It's just the political abuse of self-determination and self-governance is just totally getting squashed. Mm-hmm. It's like we're invisible. So I think that is a sign as to just exercise our rights then. Not just going out there and protesting and going rah, rah, rah. Because that don't work. And you can't run a nation or a community from the classroom. You know, eventually you got to get out there and get your hands dirty. You know, get out there and you're going to learn so much more to what you already have, you know.
I mean, we had a chance to talk to Bumpy and Brandon, who were really big figures in the activism aspect. So they had a lot of participation in the groundwork in terms of, like, getting out there in the community. And then, you know, talking to you, you are a scholar and deeply involved in academia. So we wanted to, in our podcast, kind of show two different perspectives or, like, two voices in terms of the sovereignty movement, so kind of pitching the academia and activism roles. So, like, do you think that there is a role in academia it plays in activism?
But, I mean, it is different, for sure. Academia is this professional track, right, that requires you to buy into certain just requirements, right? Like, I have to write a book, I have to teach classes. I think especially the Hawaiian case shows that it doesn't have to be completely separate, right? Like, what I'm going to be able to do in my career, I hope, is at least to teach this history differently and that, like, create more awareness about, yeah, U.S. empire and U.S. settler colonialism. And I think it's really criminal how, like, students in the U.S. get this history at all. And that's a small contribution I can make in my daily. Like, I hope to bring activists and artists and scholars from Hawaii to speak at Riverside. And I think there are some ways that academia can foster more activists.
So in our research in the Hawaiian sovereignty movement and through our discussions with Brandon, Bumpy, and Miley, we discovered that it's important to address three main components to the movement, and that includes cultural sovereignty, political sovereignty, and economic sovereignty.
So, Hashim, what is your understanding of the sovereignty movement?
I think it's hard because the United States pushes assimilation as one of its fundamental parts of becoming American. Mm-hmm. To that kind of has this inherent self of losing identity, this concept of, you know, you're just American now. versus having your own individual heritage, which I think is a struggle that is within these indigenous communities as well. They're just trying to retain identity as well as fight against this this sense of assimilation. Yeah.
And Miley talked a lot about that and about how that's kind of, that was what was happening when Hawaii first became a state, and a lot of the indigenous people were on board with that, possibly because they didn't know the ramifications of becoming a state. And so a lot of people were on board with assimilation when Hawaii first became a state. And they, Miley told us that her mother wasn't allowed to speak her native language growing up, and most of her generation wasn't allowed to speak her native language growing up. And something I found particularly interesting about what Miley spoke about was erasure of indigenous languages in Hawaii partakes in something that's been coined as necrolinguistics, which was a term created by John Mugain, who mostly studies slavery and how when enslaved peoples were brought over from Africa, they were not allowed to speak their own languages as a way to cut them off from their cultural connections and to kill their culture and to kill their relations to their native home. And so it's very interesting to me that that was happening in Hawaii for the indigenous people.
This is actually a perfect kind of parallel to the indigenous struggles felt by populations in the continental United States with, whether it was the Cherokee Nation, when the United States tried to have a forceful assimilation.
Often through boarding schools.
The boarding schools, as well as trying to have native groups pick up property rights and
the adoption program,
be a part of the United States proper. And this struggle is kind of a parallel to this Hawaiian issue.
To flow from Hashim's last comment about how the U.S. pushes assimilation.
So I personally feel that one of the biggest issues within responding to assimilation and assimilative practices is that a critical mass is needed for a difference to be seen on a larger scale. And by the idea of a critical mass, I don't mean that 51% of the population. I mean that there needs to be a large enough group for people to begin to take notice. And I believe this can particularly be seen in a lot of the cultural part of the sovereignty movement. Because of the US narrative of multiculturalism, cultural sovereignty is the easiest thing for different ethnic and racial groups to embrace. And this can be seen in Hawaii, where indigenous people have the first thing indigenous people have embraced has been a revitalization of their culture and of their language. And that and a lot of the effects of colonialism have been recognized through this and through the effects of colonialism on their culture and on their language and what colonialism has done to erase that. And this has been able to provide a critical mass of people to get the Hawaiian sovereignty movement going.
It seems to me that a large part of the critical mass production has been through the engagement of children and their families through the school system.
Well, they've started incorporating more learning of the Native Hawaiian language. What Miley was saying was as generations continued to learn less and less of the Native Hawaiian culture, it just slowly trickled down to the point where the newest generations weren't learning enough about it and they just became completely assimilated. And that's why the Hawaiian Renaissance was so important, because it was kind of a revitalization of cultural identity. People became more interested in learning about their native language. They wanted to engage in those traditions in the Hawaiian school system, and that they are starting to teach that again because they found that it is rewarding for them to re-engage in that cultural history.
So something that I think is important to remember, which we spoke about with Miley, is that Native Hawaiians were never completely assimilated. If they were, it would have been impossible for the emergence of today's sovereignty movement. The work that they put in, that was put in to end the Hawaiian language, was not individual choices, but structures put in place by the government. It's also important to note that Native Hawaiians, I think it's important to note that Native Hawaiians have been learning and speaking English prior to their becoming a U.S. territory, as they were trading with Britain and other and the US and other English-speaking countries. But it was in 1896 that the Hawaiian language was outlawed in public and private schools, which lasted until 1987, hence why the Cultural Renaissance is so important.
Okay, so what is this Hawaiian Renaissance?
That's a great question. So after Hawaii was considered a territory, it was then a lot of Native Hawaiians wanted to fit into the new culture that they had just joined. And so in order to do that, they had to pick up English. They had to drop Native Hawaiian. And the culture just slowly started to die down because no one was practicing. No one was speaking these languages. And so the Hawaiian Renaissance movement picked up in the sense that people found a new interest in learning these languages again. And through that, it was a phase in which actively taught others to learn the language, to do these practices. And it was a general celebration of the Hawaiian culture that was new and necessary for the preservation of this identity.
My understanding is that the seeds for the Hawaiian Renaissance were planted like during the 1960s as a response to the various like third world and civil rights movements happening on the mainland.
It's a really good point because in talking to Ian, he had actually mentioned that the Hawaiian sovereignty movement has a lot of correlations with the civil rights movement in the South that Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights leaders and activists were involved in.
Bumpy spoke a little about some of the tactics involved with the movement that work alongside the Cultural Renaissance. Do you want to play that clip?
You know, we had, you know, peace, friendship, and commerce treaties with, you know, over 20, 30 countries. So they were all violated. So it's kind of like we're caught in the, we have to stay in aloha, right? Because that's the way that this movement was from our elders, from our ancestors. And the only thing that is keeping it in this slow process and taking all this abuse is because it's peaceful and nonviolent. That's the only thing we got. And so it's more, to me, it's more like a 21st century type of genocide in paradise, right? And it's happening, it's real subtle, you know, it's...
He spoke about some of the plans for the future of Hawaii's sovereignty, and I think we have a clip of that.
You know, these guys are talking about, you know, a possible Hawaiian government, maybe federally recognized or recognition through international treaties, reopen the treaty again, you know. We had, you know, peace, friendship, and commerce treaties with, you know, over 20, 30 countries. You know, I think that Hawaii, the freedom of Hawaii to go back and do the right thing is probably the blessing that this world needs right now. You know, because we need something to stop people from killing each other. You know, and we at this village and the things we do and all the way down to our kids know that. We know that we have to restore aloha. We have to restore those things. And that's what we're doing. You know, so the movement is not necessarily like what's going on around the world or in America, because we have a different situation going on. You know, it's totally international. And we got caught up in processes that were meant for us that never got to us. And today is what's happening. That's what's going on. The Royal Commission, the 122,000, you know, Hawaiians that are signed up, verified. You know, we probably went through the strictest process out of anybody in Hawaii, you know.
And Brandon shared what he felt the role of the U.S. in Hawaii's future is.
We need to open up our peace treaty with America and operate as, you know, as brothers, like we once were. That's an option we are going to explain to our delegation inside our convention. There's two options now. There's an independence Hawaii, and there is a federally recognized Hawaii. which is still underneath America. So those are the two factions right now that are lining up to get ready to talk in this convention. And are people going to decide in that convention what is the next step for our people politically? It's up to us. You know, we cannot ask anymore, because asking never gets us nowhere. You know, there's laws already in place. We need to just use these laws to get to the point where we're talking on the same level with America again. Not asking them, not being subservient to them, but we're talking at them at political, you know, as we once were in 1893. And it's up to our people to decide how we want to treat ourselves. We're going to fully recognize ourselves as a Hawaiian that we always have been for thousands of years. It's the creation of Hawaiians. Or are we going to be this new type of Hawaiian that's been, you know, assimilated and wants federal recognition and just wants to, you know, be comfortable as being an American? And that's not, you know, that's not to say that's wrong, but that's everybody's own political right.
Yeah.
As a Hawaiian, I have my own political aspirations. My uncle has his own political aspirations. So we got to just get honest with ourselves. Have these honest conversations like, oh, we talking with you about all the races, because this is a mind mess inside our heads, because we've been taught to be ashamed of our culture and to be, you know, just get along. Hey, get along, everybody. This is aloha. This is what aloha is. That's not what aloha is. Aloha is not to let you walk all over me. You know, aloha is me respecting you and then you showing the same respect for me.
Mm-hmm.
This is our home here. You know, whatever happens after we make our decision happens, because that's just how time happens.
Miley and Angela spoke of the ways in which this can be seen in the 2014 meetings on Native Hawaiian recognition with the U.S. Department of Interior.
The U.S. did a similar thing with the Interior Department meetings. Like, they just wanted to kind of show that they knew that they were in the wrong, but they didn't necessarily take action to right these wrongs.
Yeah. I feel like they had a different idea of what needed to be changed, right? So that the Department of Interior just thought, oh, we'll give you recognition and that will, you know, solve all your problems.
Yeah, that'll be enough.
Like, obviously, Native Hawaiians have a different understanding of what their root problem is.
Mm-hmm.
Hawaiians having a space to talk about these issues, and that we haven't really had that in such a public way. And I think in maybe unintentional effect of the hearings is that a lot of people got more educated or excited about
the movement,
just the sovereignty movement again.
One of the main ways the U.S. government has worked to create a pretense of helping Native Hawaiians is through the creation of the Hawaiian Homelands,
which is their attempt at giving access to housing back to the indigenous population. But access to these houses rely on blood quantum, and the amount they create is nowhere near equivalent to the amount of the poor indigenous population, or just the indigenous population.
That, and you have to prove so much that it becomes a waiting game for America, some people spend their entire lives on the waiting list. Because if you can wait out the blood quantum level to go below the required threshold,
50%.
Yeah, we would require threshold, which is not very. It's easy to go below that. Then they no longer have a claim, and in effect, to become assimilated. It has they're no longer
indigenous.
We also spoke to Miley about how the U.S. is able to give these lands to the indigenous population, and the history of how the U.S. came to hold these lands in the first place.
They were open to, you know, they were invested in being a modern nation state. So it wasn't like they were totally against developing these businesses, but they did always want to try to figure out ways to, you know, support Hawaiian rights and to support sort of common Hawaiian people. And so in 1848, King Kamehameha III changed laws about land ownership in Hawaii. And so it was called the Great Mahele. There could be private land ownership in Hawaii. Hawaiians to have their own rights to land. So, like, this was ostensibly supposed to help protect Native Hawaiian land, right? Basically, that this all was premised on the idea that Native Hawaiian commoners would go and like sign up for land parcels, but it seems like they didn't really understand what that meant, or it wasn't widely pursued by the common people. So what ended up happening was, like, through those that land that was set aside for the common people, it increasingly became bought up by foreign landowners. And that's sort of where, from that land is where a lot of the plantations came out of, that were not controlled by Native Hawaiians anymore, but mm-hmm. by these foreign landowners.
Wow.
Large part where land became dispossessed was through the overthrow. So in 1893, well, Queen Liliuokalani wanted to pass more rights for Native Hawaiians.
Mm-hmm.
And then so that these plantation owners were upset and they decided that she shouldn't be the ruler anymore. So basically they did a coup mm-hmm. and they stormed the palace.
Wow.
Armed, and also they had the backing of the U.S. Navy that was stationed in Honolulu Harbor. Once they overthrew the Hawaiian Kingdom, they gained control over all of those lands that had been set aside for the crown. So they're called the Crown Lands.
Oh, wow.
And they annexed Hawaii as a territory in 1898.
Uh-huh.
When the U.S. formally took over Hawaii from that the government that had been formed by the plantation owners, then the U.S. took over control of the Crown Lands.
Wow.
So that's, you know, it was all very illegal.
Yeah.
And because the annexation of Hawaii was through this joint resolution in the U.S. Congress, and not a treaty between the U.S. and
Hawaii.
The Hawaiian Kingdom, then, like, that was illegal. Like, there's no way that it shouldn't be possible for just one country to pass an internal resolution
mm-hmm.
about annexing another country, right? Like, that's pretty crazy.
I could be wrong, but I thought the U.S. admitted that it was illegal in the apology resolution.
Right, yeah, that's right. So that's part of the reason why in 1993 they admitted that, they had played a role in the overthrow, and that everything that had happened was illegal under U.S. law and international law. But they said that they're sorry, but it didn't change.
Yeah.
The effects of the U.S. and U.S. corporations owning lands, as well as the structures in place that only give most Native Hawaiians access to low-wage jobs, mean that a huge issue in Hawaii at the moment is homelessness, which is why one of the key parts of the sovereignty movement is gaining economic sovereignty for Native Hawaiians.
So, Bumpy has had decades of experience working as an activist towards the Hawaiian sovereignty movement, and one of his greatest achievements is establishing a village called Pu'uhanua o Waimanalo, and he acquired the lease for the land in 1994 following an extensive beach occupation. And today, 21 years later, they are thriving as an independently run self-sustaining community, and the federal government for the most part leaves it alone, and that has been a great attribute to their success today.
It seems by talking to Bumpy that one of the key components of that is that they are economically independent. And that independence seems to be almost an example for the economic sovereignty that they wish for the indigenous people as a whole.
And so other things that Bumpy's involved in today is working on the project of establishing a First National Hawaiian Bank. And this bank is a means for Native Hawaiians to invest in their future by giving them agency over their own money and land. The National Bank is going to be completely autonomous, not connected to other federal or corporate banks, and they're working with Bank of America to collect a large fund to invest in this bank so that Native Hawaiians will be able to work on, you know, this corporation on their own. And so it would be controlled completely by Native Hawaiians to better serve Native Hawaiians. So having a national bank would give them an improved access to financial loans for, you know, local businesses or even home loans. And ultimately, it would empower Native Hawaiians and give them a greater chance of success. And, you know, that's one of the first stepping stones to addressing a major issue that targets Native Hawaiian demographic, which is homelessness.
Hopefully, what we've spoken about today has made the importance of cultural, political, and economic sovereignty clear. Before we share our final thoughts on the matter, we wanted to give a few shout-outs.
We wanted to thank you. Thank you for listening and for giving us this opportunity to learn. It's been an amazing experience for all of us.
Thank you to Dr. Miley Arvin, Assistant Professor of Ethnic Studies at UC Riverside, for taking the time to talk to us twice, each time imparting invaluable knowledge and encouragement.
Thank you to Dennis Bumpy Kanahele and Brandon Makaawawa for speaking with us, sharing their personal experiences, and giving us inspiring insight. Shout out to their village Pu'uhonua Owaya Manolo for their ongoing success and their nonprofit organization Aloha First for their efforts in driving the movement forward.
Thank you to Ian Chan Hodges, Chief Negotiator for the First National Bank, for his initial help in the beginning stages of our project. We can't thank him enough for connecting us to Bumpy. Shout out to his work with the First National Bank, which will have a powerful impact on the movement and the lives of thousands.
Shout out to the Huipu, a coalition of independent nation organizations that unites various grassroots groups in support of the independence movement.
Shout out to organizations like the Institute for Human Services that are dedicated towards ending and preventing the growing issues of homelessness in Hawaii. Their efforts are making a difference.
And of course, shout out to the Kanaka Maoli, or Native Hawaiians, who are at the crux of this movement, whose participation and involvement are critical at this defining moment in time.
In the end, I think one of the greatest messages that we can take away from our discussions with Brandon, Bumpy, and Miley is something that Brandon brought up, which is right now there is and there has to be a sense of urgency for the Native Hawaiian movement. We can't just let it, you know, sit around and, you know, mull over for the next couple of years, because that's what's been happening in the last decade.
And there's been a small, an acute group of people working towards sovereignty, and their work is making a difference. And that work is about to affect all Indigenous Hawaiian people, all people in Hawaii, and should it be successful in becoming an independent nation, it will have huge international ramifications.
Yeah. We're at a crux of the culmination of decades and decades of work and dedication, and there's going to be massive aftershocks after this. It's a ripple effect. We'll just have to see where the Native Hawaiian sovereignty movement goes from here.
And I think this is why we're here, why we're doing this podcast, why we're trying to raise awareness for these issues. I think these struggles that are fought by the Indigenous communities in Hawaii and elsewhere are ramifications of a colonized mind, which Brandon spoke to earlier about decolonizing. Each of these steps, I think, are important, but this call to action Brandon speaks about is something that needs to be pushed on, because there becomes a point where what you do can have a huge effect on the way you live your life. And I think at this point,
it can have a huge effect on who you are, even. I think is more what Brandon was saying, is it all starts with you.
That's it from us. We are
Hawaiian Sovereign 3. And we thank you for listening.
You can find more podcasts about other prevalent issues on our website, nativequestions.com.